have chosen these sutras. That is Sutta 33, Majjhima Nikaya, the Greater Discourse on the Cowherd. The reason why I chose this because of this sutta is really relevant. It's not only to monastic but also apply to lay people too, you know. So I find that this is a very good sutta and it's relevant to everyone. So I will start to read out the suttas. Then after that they have each of the qualities. Then I will read out the each of the qualities. Then I will explain the qualities. Then after I finish the suttas, and if someone have any questions, and you can raise, or you want me to stop and each time I read, or I explain all the qualities, then after that you still have questions, then you raise questions. Is it there's a better way? Okay. So the Sutta 33, Maha Gopalaka Suttas. So the Greater Discourse on the Cowherd. So I will read out the suttas. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta Grove, Anathapindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, when a cowherd possesses 11 fetters, he is incapable of keeping and rallying a herd of cattle. What 11? Here, a cowherd has no knowledge of form. He is unskilled in characteristic. He fails to pick up flies' eggs. He fails to dress wounds. He fails to smoke out the sheds. He does not know the watering place. He does not know what is to have drunk. He does not know the road. He is unskilled in pasture. He milks dry, and he shows no extra venerations to those bulls who are fathers and leaders of the herd. When a cowherd possesses these 11 factors, he is incapable of keeping and rallying a herd of cattle. So too, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu possesses 11 qualities, he is incapable of growth, increase, and fulfillment in this dhamma and discipline. What 11? Here a bhikkhu has no knowledge of form, he's unskilled in characteristic, he fails to pick up flies' eggs, he fails to dress wounds, he fails to smoke out shades, he does not know the watering place. He does not know what is to have drunk. He does not know the road. He is unskilled in pasture. He milks dry, and he shows no extra venerations to those elder bhikkhus of long standing who have long gone forth, the fathers and the leaders of the Sangha. So this the Buddha's mentioned, like if someone possesses these qualities, then we will not have any growth in our dhamma. So they say sometimes that it's important that we know what are the qualities that we need to develop. Because sometimes people focus so much on, they think that, oh, okay, meditation, that's it. That's all. But no, more than that. So we have to know what are really stopping us from growth in the dhamma. Sometimes certain qualities that really is an obstacle to us in our practice. So it's good that we know what are the qualities. Sometimes we need to develop certain qualities to help us to grow in the Dhamma. So the Buddha mentioned these 11 qualities. So the first qualities, so the Buddha said, how has a bhikkhu no knowledge of form? Here a bhikkhu does not understand as it actually is thus. All material form of whatever kind consists of four great elements, and the material form derived from four great elements. That is how a bhikkhu has no knowledge of form. So the Buddha This is, it means that we have no understanding that our body is just like any matter, you know? Because this human being, this being, made out of mind and body. So our body is like mind and matter. So it's like any matter in this earth. Make up of fire element, air element, water element, earth element. So when we die, when we cremate our body, so we go to earth, we go the water element, you know, and it's all go back to the nature. So we just part. So it's nothing so special of our body. Our body is just like part of anything in the world. Just make up of all these four elements. So, but because of we don't have the understanding. So we take this body to be something so special, and that is something that is permanent. So something that is, you know, to be me, to be mine. So this body is not me and mine. They're just part of the nature, and we are just part of the nature. So it arises, everything is going to pass away, even the body. So it arises and it goes back to nature. So that is not me and mine. So they said, when we have this, then we create lots of suffering for ourselves. We think that this body is me and mine, and we have this attachment. So we have no knowledge. The Buddha said, no knowledge, don't have the right understanding. Thinking that this is the body, this is my body, and they think that it's great and attached to the body. And try to make the body, when the body gets sick, old, you know, then we have illness, and we are not happy. And we think there's something wrong. But it's just part of the nature. Our body is just like anything in the nature, make up of these four elements. That is nothing so special. So this is the first one the Buddha said. So there's no knowledge of form. So the second quality said is, how is a bhikkhu unskilled in characteristic? Here a bhikkhu does not understand as it actually is. Thus, a fool is characterized by his action. A wise man is characterized by his action. That is how a bhikkhu is unskilled in characteristic. That means that, like sometimes, this is how to discriminate, you know. It's not like, for example, like a teacher. You know whether the teacher, not by what the teacher said. Someone can give a great, you know, profound teaching, but he judge a person by the person's behavior. It's not by the person, how good the person said, you know, what the person said. The person can give a beautiful, you know, profound thoughts, but their behavior, their conduct can be really, you know, and we judge, it's not judge on, based on how the person behaved, the conduct. So we can tell by the person, you know, through the person conduct. If the person, I remember in one of Ajahn Brahm talks, he's mentioned about in the early days when he was still a lay person, he was so inspired by one of the monks that is in England. So he was so inspired and listened to his Dharma talk. And then he listened to the first Dharma talk and the second Dharma talk. And then he's just looking forward to the third one. But the third Dharma talk never came through. And later he discovers that this monk disrobed and married. So he says sometimes some people, he said, he's giving this profound teaching at the same time he's planning his wedding. You know? So that's why he said, you know, anyone can teach, but we judge. You know, so if you want to know the teacher, whether they are really, you know, living, they really teach what they really live, what they preach, so you have to really observe them. Even the Buddha said, at least, you know, you have to stay with them and then observe them at least for a few years. Then you know that person. It's not by what the person just said. You know, so it's by the person's conduct. So then when it come up, like whether we, for example, have a friend, so we know whether this is a good person or not when we choose a good friend, isn't it? So it's true that person's behavior and conduct is not just because that person can speak very well and very profound and beautiful, you know, and that is not. But we judge the person through observing that person's behavior and conduct. So the Buddha said, so that we associate with the wise, not associate with the fool. So because it's very important who we associate with. So the Buddha said that to have a companion, a good friend, in a friendship is a whole of our, he said, whole of a holy life, spiritual life. It's very important. That's why who we choose, you know, to associate with is important. So we observe, we judge to look at the behavior and the conduct, whether this is a good, you know, wise person or not. So it's a foolish person, so we are not going to associate with them. So this is what is meant. So if we are always, just imagine, if we don't know how to judge and we associate with someone foolish, so we ended up is just the same, you know. Like I remember sometimes ago, someone said, if you want to lose weight, you make sure that you don't associate with someone that do not wish to lose weight, because it's difficult, because you are in that, you know, in the middle of these people. So that's why it's who we associate with. Actually, it's important that we have be able to discriminate what is good for us. So, and the third qualities. So, how does a bhikkhu fail to pick out flies' eggs? Here, when a thought of sensual desires has arisen, a bhikkhu tolerates it. He does not abandon it, is remove it, do away with it, and annihilate it. When a thought of ill will has arisen, when a thought of cruelty has arisen, when evil unwholesome things have arisen, a bhikkhu tolerates them. He does not abandon them, remove them, do away with them, annihilate them. That's how a bhikkhu fails to pick up flies' eggs. This is means that when this flies eggs, if you leave it too long, so how is it turns out? It's a hatch, isn't it? It's a maggot. So the same thing. So when we have this unwholesome state of mind, like of these negativities, you know, like ill will, cruelty, that arises in our mind. So if we do not deal with it, abandon it, you know, especially when it haven't grown to grow, you know, when it started, you know, slightly, you know, we know that, for example, if someone irritates us, we have lots of anger towards someone. And if we are not aware of that and deal with that, and this will grow. It's like a demon, for example, the anger. So it's grow and grow and grow. Because if someone irritates us and then we focus, yeah, this person is terrible, and we go on and on and on. And actually, we are reinforced the anger. So the next time when you meet this person again, your angers grow worse than the first time, because it's grow, it's reinforced. And at one time, then you know, you keep, and then maybe sometimes we either push it away or we run away, you know. So we pretend that it's not there, and we suppress that. So when we suppress it, you know, or we feed it, it's grow. It's just like, you know, when we give this nutriment to, you know, to the plant or to anything, it's grow, isn't it? So this unwholesome state of mind is grow and grow until a point that we can't hold ourselves anymore. Sometimes we think that we will not do something horrible or really hurt someone. But it's, you know, it's just recently that someone that I know that the person killed his wife, like, because of being built up, you know? Because the problem is there. And sometimes people pretend that it's not there and then they just push it aside. So until a point that it just keep develop, to a point that you can't hold. And it's like the bomb is just explode. You can't hold back. Because it's grow. That's why it's important that we know that, you know, not to underestimate when we have ill will, you know. For example, like even partners, you know, that it's happened because of they keep it to themselves. Because we should like communicate to make the other person know how you feel, to deal with that, not to allow that, you know, to grow. So have to, the Buddha said, you know, have to abandon it, have to deal with that. Sometimes we tend to underestimate when this, you know, you let it grow. So to the point that you can't hold. So they said sometimes we thought that we will not do such a thing. So as long as we still have this great hatred and delusion, when the condition is right, we still do something, you know, that we usually don't do, you know. Like this person, a lot of people were surprised that he's such a calm person. And the friends, they don't believe that, you know, he looks so peaceful and calm. I just couldn't believe that, you know. If you still have that, the underlying tendency is there. So they say it's grow. They say sometimes when we get agitated, when we get irritated, we really have to look at it, not to let it grow. So just like the fly's eggs, it's grow, it's become a maggot. So this is what the Buddhas mean. They say it's important that we have to practice mindfulness, you know, mindfulness, meditation, so we'll be able to pick up, you know, to know, to aware, the awareness, self-awareness, the what's going on within us. Then we can, when it is small, we can deal with it. When it's built up, we can't even hold. It's just out of control. So that's why this is what the Buddha's name. So so followed by this quality, that is, how does the bhikkhu fails to dress wounds? Here, on seeing a form with the eyes, a bhikkhu grasps at its sign and features. Even though when he leaves the eye's faculties unguarded, evil unwholesome speaks of covetousness and grief might invade him. He does not practice the way of its restraint. He does not guard the eye faculties. He does not undertake the restraint of the eye faculties. On hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an audio with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind, he grasps at the sign and features. Even though when he leaves the mind faculties unguarded, even unwholesome state of covetousness and grief might invade him. He does not practice the way of its restraint. He does not guard the mind faculties. He does not undertake the restraint of the mind faculties. That is how a bhikkhu fails to dress wound. So this is that the Buddha said, this is that we do not know how to restrain ourselves. You know, that a sense restraint. So this is what the Buddha means, to practice sense restraint. So here, it means that, for example, like we see an object. So whenever there is a contact, you know, feeling arises. So we hear something, or we see something, or we hear something that we don't like. You know, something says something nasty to us. That is a contact, isn't it, when there is an object? So sound object. So that feelings arises. So we either have the feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So normally that is neutral, we will not get caught, we don't pay attention. Sometimes we just ignore that. But when there is light or dislike, this is really we get into trouble. So something that is, you know, pleasant, then when we give rise to light, I like this, greed, you know, and something that we don't like, that is aversion, we try to get rid of it, you know, push it away, try to get rid of things. So that is how not be able to restrain ourselves. Restrain doesn't mean that it's different from suppress. So for example, if our anger arises, so it doesn't help if we suppress or express it. So when we express it, then we say something nasty back. For example, we hear something, someone said nasty thing to us. So when we express it, then we say something back, you know, nasty. Or we suppress it. Suppress is different from restrain. Suppress is that you are not knowing. You don't have the awareness. You just push it like, and then become an habitual pattern. You don't even know that you are doing it. So each time things that you don't like, you use willpower. It's not using the wisdom power. But restrain that you consciously aware. You have the awareness that, okay, because you have the calmness, you have the awareness, you hear something, you have this awareness that you know that at this moment I'm not happy. I have anger, I have evil in this moment. So you restrain yourself not to react. That is different with the understanding. So, and be able to observe, you know, the arising of the feelings, the unpleasant feelings, and the passing away of the pleasant feelings. That is different. But pushing away, like sometimes people tend to just push it away, but the mind is a conditioned thing. So when we do it all the time, it's become like the, you know, the default setting, you know. And next time, things that we don't like, you know, we don't even know that we are doing it. That's the problem. So until a point that, you know, and it's building up, we reinforce, so we restrain. So restrain, like here the Buddhas mean like you see something and eye contact with an object and things. It's nothing wrong. It's not the object itself, it's so much a problem. It's not the object itself. It's not that we close our eyes not to see, not to hear, not to taste. It's not that. It's we be able to see where our problem coming from. It's between the object and the mind. It arises when there is a contact, there is feeling arises, that is where the clinging, the holding on, that is the problem. So it's not a matter of we shut ourselves up, you know, that we just no hearing, no touching and no seeing. It's not. That is the problem. Is that so we have to know how to dress wound. That's like the Buddha said, where is the problem is. A lot of people thinking that is the object is a problem. For example, someone says something nasty to them and they think that that person causes them suffering, without knowing that the suffering is not come from that person. It's come from when there is a contact, that is the feelings arises, that the attachment of that, the object and the mind between what arises, that we're holding on, we're attached to, that really causes the suffering. That is the problem. That is the wound that we need to address. So sometimes we tend to, for example, the wound is here, we bandage the other way, we address somewhere else. So we are not addressing the problem. So then people try to think that, oh, this person is nasty, I try to get rid of this person. So I get rid of this person, I'd be happy, I'd be fine. Because my problem is come from this person, but it's not. So because it's not dealt with. So the Buddha said like, you not be able to address the wound. You have to know where is the problem coming from. That is why the Buddha man know how to address the wound, knowing where the problem is coming from. So we only know where this problem coming from, the source of the suffering, then only we be able to address, isn't it? If we don't know the problem, where is it coming from, the source of the suffering coming from, we can't address the problem. So we were looking at the wrong place. Looking at the place that we think that we causes the suffering, but actually it's not. That's why if we keep addressing, you know, not be able to address our problem, then this is how we have no, don't have the growth in the Dhamma. So this is what the Buddha means. So he's come to the fifth one. So how does a bhikkhu feel to smoke out the shades? Here, a bhikkhu does not teach others in detail the Dhamma as he has learned and mastered it. It is how a bhikkhu feels to smoke out shades. That means that someone does not teach others in detail the Dhamma as he has learned and mastered. It doesn't mean that some people have the perceptions that, someone have to be enlightened in order to teach. So actually it's not, the Buddha said that, you know, actually that you see that the Buddha said, you know, the monks and nuns, you know, they should teach. They just teach what they know. And just to be honest, you know that much, you teach that much. Things that you don't know, you say, I don't know. So that much we can teach. It's the same thing. Lay people can teach. It's not that only monks and nuns can teach. Like, it's applied to everybody. Like things that you can share with your friends. You can help. Then you share. You just tell them how much you know. And things that you don't know, you just be honest that I don't know. So how much we know, we just teach how much we know. And we be able to share. So this is what it means. Feels to smoke out the shades. And it's come to the six qualities. So how does a bhikkhu not know the watering place? Here a bhikkhu does not go from time to time to those bhikkhus who have learned much, who are well versed in the tradition, who maintain the Dhamma, the discipline and the course. And he does not inquire and ask questions of them. Thus, how is this venerable, sir? What is the meaning of this? This venerable ones do not reveal to him what has not been revealed, do not clarify what is not clear, or remove his doubts about the numerous things that give rise to doubt. That is how a bhikkhu does not know what the watering place. So this is, that means that a bhikkhu is not, for example, that if you don't understand certain things, like they said, the discipline and the Dhamma and the codes, for example, the codes means that, like they said, Four Noble Truths, for example. So if you don't really understand what is really the Four Noble Truths, so we should can ask someone what is meant by Four Noble Truths. If they say, the Noble Four Path, so what is this Noble Four Path? And if they talk about three characteristics, what is this three characteristics? So things that we don't understand, we have doubts, we should ask, raise questions. That's why the Buddha used to say that, you know, if you want to born to be intelligent in next life, you ask questions this life. So it's important that those things that we don't understand, we ask. Those that, you know, that we don't, because sometimes we don't know whether we're practicing, whether we are heading in the right direction. Sometimes it's good that from time to time, so we have to go to someone that, you know, they have a practice, you know, long before us, and they have they're knowledgeable. So we go and ask them, you know, to get them the advice from them, you know, to ask them what does this mean, and so that we know whether we are practicing the right way, heading the right directions. Is it we are on the right path? Actually, it's important. If we don't have these qualities, we don't ask questions, we don't, you know, then we don't have growth in the Dhamma. They say it's important, these qualities. So then the it's come to that seven qualities. That is, how does a bhikkhu not know what is to have drunk? Here, when the Dhamma and discipline program proclaimed by the Tathagata is being taught, a bhikkhu does not gain inspirations in the meaning, does not gain inspirations in the Dhamma, does not gain gladness connected with the Dhamma. That is how a bhikkhu does not know what is to have drunk. So, we study Vinaya, no, we study suttas, the Buddha's teaching. It's not just like, you know, it's just maybe some people like study suttas and to gain the knowledge to be able to let other people know that I'm so good. I remember suttas, this sutta, that. I remember them all. They're really good at arguing. So this is not the point that why we study suttas. We study suttas is that to inspire us. To give us the inspiration. We feel inspired with delight in the Dhamma. So give us the strength to practice. It's not just, you know, to show that we know better, you know. It's not that. So we have to understand that it's for the inspirations. So in this Dhammapada, so the Buddha said the gift of Dhamma excel all gifts. So the taste of Dhamma excels all tastes. The delight in Dhamma excels all delights. So with delights in reading suttas, you know, give us a lot of inspiration because we need that. That's like why we study the Buddha's scripture, we study the suttas. It's because of that. It's not to try to show off that how many suttas that I can remember. So this is the main purpose of, you know, we studying suttas. So now come to the next qualities, the Buddha said. How does a bhikkhu not know the root? Here a bhikkhu does not understand the Noble Eightfold Path as it actually is. That is not how a bhikkhu does not know the root. So there's the Noble Eightfold Path. That is the first one, right view, right intention, right speech, right actions, right livelihood, right effort, right concentrations, and right mindfulness. So this whole path. So we always go back to the Noble Eightfold Path. We cultivate the whole path of practice. So we know the road. We know that this is a Noble Eightfold Path. This is the path, you know, that we have to follow. This is the way. This is the Buddha's pointed out this, the Noble Eightfold Path. Then it's followed like by the next quality is that there is someone possess these qualities, then will not increase, will not have incapable of growth in the Dhamma. That is, how is a bhikkhu unskilled in posture? Here, a bhikkhu does not understand the four foundations of mindfulness as they actually are. That is how a bhikkhu is unskilled in posture. That is the four foundations of mindfulness. That is the Satipatthana. That does not understand these four foundations of mindfulness, sustain the mindfulness, you know, on one of these four postures. That is the own body, feelings, the mind consciousness, and the object of the mind, investigation of the Dhamma. So the Satipatthana actually is, these four foundations of mindfulness actually is a very profound practice. So a lot of people think that, you know, oh, it's easy. So actually this four focus of mindfulness method is taught by the Lord Buddha is a very advanced practice. So advanced that the Lord Buddha said that if anyone should develop them in the way he described, so for only 7 days, then they would achieve full enlightenment or the state of non-returner. So that is very advanced. So it's, this four foundation of mindfulness is a really super duper mindfulness. It's not those gross mindfulness. You know, this is really refined mindfulness. So This one, if one, the Buddha described how this is this this fourfold of mind Satipatthana practice is that if one want to practice the four foundations of mindfulness in the way that Lord Buddha described, that this leads to rapidly to enlightenment, then certain things are required before you begin. There are some prerequisites for that. So required before that. The essential preparations, the prerequisites, that is the full cultivations of the other seven factors of enlightenment. The noble four path that we need to cultivate. That is the whole path. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. I mean the Sila, Samadhi. So when you fulfill this, then you have Panya. So that is Sila. That is at least keeping five precepts. That is the morality. The longer, the better. Then the Bhavana. The Bhavana, that is the cultivations of the mind. The cultivation of the stillness. That is the cultivation of the mind. Here the Buddha referred to the abandoning the five hindrances. Because the five hindrances is the one to cloud the mind. So we do not see things as they really are. So we need to practice the calmness, you know, the meditation in the calmness. So to the stage that this absorption, to the state that we abandon the five hindrances. So your mind is clear, you have the clarity. There's no more five hindrances. The five hindrances, there is the desires, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt. When we have these five hindrances, our mind is not clear. So that is really advanced practice, that you abandon five hindrances. Only then you practice four foundations of mindfulness. It's not that every day we think that we just lifting and we think that we are mindful. It's not the kind of that type of mindfulness really advanced. You have to be able to have this absorption, you know, attain this absorption and abandon these five hindrances. So with the absence of the five hindrances, you have the clarity of mind. Then you'll be able to investigate the Dharma, investigate the three characteristics into that. Before that, you can't, because the mind is not, it don't have the clarity. It's still clouded with the five hindrances. So this is what the Buddha meant by they're not unskilled in the posture. So followed by the next qualities the Buddha's mentioned, that is, how does a bhikkhu milk dry? Here, when a faithful householder invite a bhikkhu to take as much as he likes of robes, alms food, resting place, and medicinal requisites, the bhikkhu does not know moderation in accepting. That is how a bhikkhu makes dry. It's just like, it's no moderation, it's like very demanding. For example, if you are so demanding, you milk dries a friend, I think all your friends will run away. Before from far they see you, they run away. Isn't it? You know, you so do demanding and have no kindness and compassion, you know, very demanding, and you think that everybody should serve us. And when your friends see you, they run away. So please don't milk dry your friends. If you milk dry your friend, all your friends run away. It's the same thing as a monks or nuns. If you become demanding in nature, and to be someone difficult to look after, then all the lay supporters run away. Actually, it's happened, you know, when I was in, many years ago, when I was in Malaysia, when I was still a lay person. So, yeah, there was a monk, you know, then everybody's so frightened of him and heard of his name. No. And because he said he's coming, someone said that everybody refused to take the responsibility to look after him because of everybody's scared. You know, it's true, you know, if you are too demanding in nature, scared, you know, everybody, all your friends see you run away, so make sure not to milk dry your friend. And squeeze until nothing left. So, then the next quality is that is, how does a bhikkhu show no extra veneration to those elder bhikkhus of long standing who have long gone forth? The fathers and the leaders of the Sangha. Here, a bhikkhu does not maintain bodily actions of loving kindness, both openly and privately towards those elder bhikkhus. He does not maintain verbal actions of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. He does not maintain mental actions of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. That is how a bhikkhu show no extra veneration to those elder bhikkhus of long standing who have long gone forth, the father and the leaders of the Sangha. So this is like, we have no respect, right, to those who are elder than us, have no loving kindness to them. So it's important, you see, they said that not only in private, not only in public, you know, in private. Like, I have seen some people, like, in front of everybody, very nice, very respectful, but they go home, then you know how they behave, you know. So it just show that, you know, oh, I'm so nice, I'm so respectful to my parents, but at home is a totally different, you know. They say that not only in public, you know, openly, but in private. So have the thoughts of loving kindness towards those, the elders, those older than us, because the respect is important. Because the respect is always come from us. So if we don't have the respect towards ourselves, we don't have respect towards others. They say if someone have no self-respect, then someone is lack of self-confidence. If someone have loss of self-respect, someone is loss of confidence. Self-confidence, that confidence in themselves. They say it's very important that if we have these qualities, we have the respect towards others, that show that we have the respect towards ourselves. Then we have this self-confidence in ourselves. This is a very important qualities for the growth in the Dhamma. Like somebody, if you have no confidence, you say, oh, no, I can't do it, it's too difficult, you know, it's not for me, you know, it's only for those that are quite advanced, I'm way far from that. So you don't even dare to try, isn't it? So you have the confidence, yes, I have, me too, you know, me too have this awakening mind. It's not like the Buddha. The Buddha is also a human being, you know. Only because of practice many lifetimes, eon lifetimes, then he perfect his paramis, his spiritual qualities. We all have the spiritual qualities, but only thing that is not up to that level, is not perfect yet. So it's not that impossible, it's yet. So that is possible. It's important that, you know, to develop the respect. Actually, the respect is come from us. So we have the self-respect, we have this self-confidence. This is how one thing leading to another, why we need to develop this quality. It helps us in the progress in the Dhamma, the growth in the Dhamma. This is, it's important that, you know, we know what are the qualities, and we reflect and we ask ourselves, what are the qualities that we lack of? What are the qualities that we need to put in more effort, you know, to cultivate more into this? Sometimes we have more qualities on this or lack of this, you know, on this qualities is not so strong. And some qualities we are more developed in some of the qualities and some is less. Then maybe actually it's important when we read the suttas, we reflect and we check ourselves. We investigate what are the qualities that I need to develop. So this is the reason why we study suttas. This is help us to have the growth in the Dhamma. So then the Buddha said, when a bhikkhu possesses these 11 qualities, he is incapable of growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline. Because when a cowherd possesses 11 fetters, he is capable of keeping and rearing a herd of cattle. What 11? So he repeat again, that is the opposite. You know, when he first talk about the 11 that is not be able, like unskilled, but this one is to cultivate the opposite. So I just read through. So here a cowherd has knowledge of farm, he is skilled in characteristic, he picks up flies eggs, he dresses wounds, he smokes out the shades, he knows the watering place, he knows what is to have drunk, he knows the road, he is skilled in pasture, he does not milk dry, and he shows extra veneration to those bulls who are fathers and leaders of the herd. When a cowherd possesses these 11 factors, he is capable of keeping and rallying a herd of cattle. So too, bhikkhus. When a bhikkhu possesses these 11 qualities, he is capable of growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline. What 11? Here, a bhikkhu has a knowledge of form, he is skilled in characteristic, he picks up flies' eggs, he dresses wounds, he smokes out the shares, he knows the watering place, he knows what is to have drunk, he knows the road, he is skilled in pasture, he does not milk dry, and he shows extra venerations to those elder bhikkhus of long standing who have long since gone forth, the fathers and the leaders of the Sangha. How does a bhikkhu have knowledge of form? Here, a bhikkhu understands as it actually is thus. All material form of whatever kind consists of the four great elements, and the material form derived from the four great elements. That is how a bhikkhu has knowledge of form. How a bhikkhu is skilled in characteristic? Here, a bhikkhu understands as it actually is thus. A fool is characterized by his action. A wise man is characterized by his action. That is how a bhikkhu is skilled in characteristics. So how does a bhikkhu pick up fly's eggs? Here, when a thought of sensual desires has arisen, a bhikkhu does not tolerate it. He abandons it. He removes it, does away with it, and annihilates it. When a thought of ill will has arisen, when a thought of cruelty has arisen, when evil unwholesome state have arisen, a bhikkhu does not tolerate them. He abandons them, removes them, does away with them, and annihilates them. That is how a bhikkhu picks up flies' eggs. How does a bhikkhu dress wounds? Here, on seeing a form with the eyes, a bhikkhu does not grasp as his sign and features, since if left the eye faculties unguarded, evil unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. He practices the way of his restraint. He guards the eye faculties. He undertakes the restraint of the eye faculties on hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an audio with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind. A bhikkhu does not grasp at the signs and features, since if he left the mind faculties unguarded, evil unwholesome state of covetousness and grief might invade him. He practices the way of his restraint. He guards the mind faculties, he undertakes the restraint of the mind faculties. That is how a bhikkhu dresses wounds. How does a bhikkhu smoke out the shades? Here, a bhikkhu teaches others in details the Dhamma as he has learned it and mastered it. That is how a bhikkhu smokes out the shades. How does a bhikkhu know the watering place? Here, a bhikkhu goes from time to time to such bhikkhus to have learned much, who are well versed in the traditions, who maintain the Dhamma, the discipline, and the codes. He inquires and asks questions of them. Thus, how is this venerable, sir? What is the meaning of this? These venerable ones reveal to him what has not been revealed, clarify what is not clear, and remove his doubts and about the numerous things that give rise to doubt. That is how a bhikkhu knows the watering place. So how does the bhikkhu know what is to have drunk? Here, when the Dhamma and the discipline proclaimed by The Tathagata is being taught. The bhikkhu gains inspirations in the meaning, gains inspirations in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. That is how a bhikkhu knows what is to have drunk. How does a bhikkhu know the root? Here, a bhikkhu understands the Noble Eightfold Path as it actually is. That is how a bhikkhu understands the root. How is a bhikkhu skilled in posture? Here, a bhikkhu understands the four foundations of mindfulness as they actually are. That is how a bhikkhu is skilled in posture. How does a bhikkhu not milk dry? Here, one faithful householder invites a bhikkhu to take as much as he likes of robes, arms, food, resting place, and medicinal requisites. The bhikkhu knows moderation in accepting. That is how a bhikkhu does not milk dry. How does a bhikkhu show extra veneration to those elder bhikkhus of long standing who have long gone forth, the father and the leaders of the Sangha? Here a bhikkhu maintains bodily acts of loving kindness, both openly and privately towards those elder bhikkhus. He maintains verbal acts of loving kindness towards them both openly and privately. He maintains mental acts of loving kindness towards them both openly and privately. That is how a bhikkhu shows extra veneration to those elder bhikkhus of long standing who have long gone forth, the fathers and the leaders of the Sangha. When a bhikkhu possesses these 11 qualities, he is capable of growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So this is the whole suttas. So is it any questions or comments that you need to ask? Because of the, you know, that time of the Buddha is just a cultural, you know, that time. So that is easier for them to understand. They use the, you know, the cows and people can understand because sometimes if you use all those technical terms and sometimes people, the head becomes so big. So you use this and it's easier, people can understand. You know, how the, you know, sometimes it's just amazing how the Buddha, you know, he's so observant and he can really, you know, make use of all this similar, you know, to give the teaching using the count, you know, but, you know, that is yeah, it's really. And there's, I have three questions. James from Cape Town. Venerable, I must enjoy music, sweet melodies, and subjective, catchy rhythms, etc. Would music be considered flies, eggs that a lay person should pick out? Or can music actually be used as meditation vehicle? I noticed that some Buddhist chanting is quite rhythmic and has a simple melody. Actually, what is here really means that there is an unwholesome state of mind. For example, like for some people, they ask, they say, you know, it's very difficult for me to calm my mind down because I'm busy. I'm working, you know, whole day. And I try very hard to sit, you know, to meditate. It's just natural. The mind, there is a transition period. Because just imagine the mind is like a vehicle travel on the highway. 120 kilometers per hour, and then you want it to stop like that. You can't. Sometimes you have to. And actually, Yeah, actually, I do suggest them sometimes that actually Ajahn Chah said whatever method that help you to calm the mind down, that is the best method. That is, no, this is the only one, or my method is the best one, my son is the only best method. No, whatever suits you. But this is not really like, if we listen to the calming music, calm our mind down, it's good, make us peaceful. It's more, it means that like this is more referred to the unwholesome state of mind that give rise to when we have the contact. We have this, for example, when we have lust and the desires, and that leads us to unwholesome deed. You know, like for example, like someone attached so much to someone and they can't get it, that give rise to anger. And this is how, like, sometimes they can't, like, sometimes the boys kill the girlfriend because the girlfriend left him. Because he attached so much. I can't get it. So I destroyed it because I can't get it. It's more meant to that, you know, the unwholesome, you know, leads to unwholesome. If we listen to those music, it makes us like the hate is really, you know, and it obsesses us and distresses us, leads us to distraction, then that is no good, you know what I mean? But if those music, because he said, I noticed that some Buddhist chanting is quite rhythmic and has a simple melody. Yeah, sometimes the chanting is good. Sometimes some people find that chanting is good. So I have someone comes up to me, he said that, you know, I've been chanting and I like to listen to the chanting and it's always calm myself down. And he said she found it very useful. And she was confused because someone told her that you should meditate. Then she was confused, should I meditate? Because I find that this is useful. Then I told her that it's fine. I said, whatever make your mind peaceful and calm, it's fine. I said, then when you feel like meditate, you meditate. I said, you continue to chant or you continue to listen to the chanting. And when you feel calm, peaceful, you feel like meditate, you meditate. So you don't have to give up chanting or listening to the chanting because it's helped you to calm your mind down. So I said, it's good. Like, you know, when we come back from work, our mind is so busy. So we use it to calm our mind before we sit. Actually, it's fine. So there's I think I answered this. I hope that I answered this person's question. So whenever, sometimes when I listen to Dharma talks, I disagree with the teacher. I feel that the teacher's talk does not make sense. Should not talk like that, and so on. Is that a bad thing to get such feelings? As a lay person, what should I do when I get such feelings? How should I stop getting such feelings? Oh, it's very good. At least he knows that how he feels. And actually, because we are not enlightened, we have to, you know, so of course we still have our views and opinions. And sometimes things do not, we develop our own views and opinions. Sometimes we attach to our views and opinions. When someone's opinions and views and opinion does not, you know, in line with what we holding on to, then we think that the person is wrong, you know. It's just that because of we holding on to our own views and opinion, then we make other people wrong. But it's fine. And don't have to feel guilty about that. And because this is just part of unenlightened. We still have the defilements. But it's good. It's fine. You know, I remember one day, a young girl, about, I think she's about 14. She come to me, she said she have a problem, she need to talk to me. So I asked her, what's your problem? She said, you know, I have anger, I have evil towards my sister. So I just very angry, and then I look at her, I said, yes, very good, I said. And she was so surprised, she looked at me, and because she said that she knows that this is no good, she tried to work with that, you know, how to work with it. Then I look at her, I said, very good. Then she was surprised. Then why? I said, very good. I said, at least you know that you have anger. You know that this is something that you need to work with. You know, it's fine. Sometimes the Buddha's teaching of non-self, we can't control what feelings arises in us, isn't it? Because we are not enlightened yet. We still have this unenlightened quality. So be aware of that. So actually it's already a big step. You know, you'll be able to aware. So it's good to delight the fact that we aware what's going on in our mind rather than beating ourselves up, thinking that, oh, it's terrible, I have these feelings. So no, it's a big step. People underestimate that, you know, that is already a big step, that is already a growth. That how many people really notice what's going on in their mind? Immediately they react. So if we know what's going on in our mind, and we know that this is something that we need to work with, it's good. It's already a big step. So we take delight in that, the fact that we'll be able to aware of this, what's going on. So it's fine. So and of course, as long as you're aware of that, just allow. He said, how should I stop getting such feelings? So you just observe these feelings arises and pass away. So not to feel it, just to know that this is happening. That's it. Let it be. So because if we try too hard to push away the feelings, the harder we try, the worse. Because whatever feeling arises is passed away. This is the Buddha's teaching, the most basic Buddhist teaching, whatever is impermanent, nothing stays. The most unpleasant feelings will not stay. It's going to, you're not going to, for example, if you get angry, you will not angry all the time, isn't it? It's angry come to the maximum point, it subsides. Even the most wonderful feelings, you know, is go high, it's come down. You know, it's not going to stay there forever. So not to worry, just to observe the feelings, that is how you feel, and not to go into the fabrication, you know. Keep the mind, you know, thinking about that, you know, and keep talking to yourself, and yeah, this monk again, oh, you see, he always said like that, he's always talked like that, and then your mind go along. So you know that, okay, this is happening. So you stop. You just allow the feelings there and aware that it's there, and not to allow the feelings go further, just to aware of that and to observe the feelings, and it arises and will pass away. So not to worry about that. So So, Venerable Madam, how do we help others gain confidence in themselves? I think this is what it means. If we want others people to have confidence in themselves, the first of all, we have to have confidence in ourselves, isn't it? It's true. So, for example, if someone tries to sell you the products that you know, how to be happy, and they look so miserable, are you going to buy the products? No. You know, if you want someone to have self-confidence in themselves, you look so like a self-confidence. You think you can help others to have self-confidence? No. The first one, you have to develop the self-confidence in ourselves. That is the first thing. Only when we help ourselves, then we help others. If we can't help ourselves, we can't help others. Isn't it? We don't even know how to be happy. Then can you help others to be happy? We can. So the first thing, to develop that ourselves first. Because before we can pull other people, we've been pulled down. You know what I mean? Sometimes we try to help others. So we don't have that in us. So before we be able to pull others people up, we already been pulled down. So this the first thing, develop the confidence in ourselves if we want to help others. So I hope this will answer the questions. I think that's all. Any more questions? Yes? Yeah. Give her the
Venerable, you were mentioning earlier on about the discernment between kind of between foolish and wise people.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of techniques might help you to cultivate that?
You have to observe.
Observant.
The person, for example, to see whether their behavior and what they said. Some people can say something, they do something else. You know? So then the person is not what the person is not preach what the person do not list what the person preach. So you need to do some observation. You need to observe the person.
Okay.
That is the observation. And it takes time. So have to be very patient.
Okay. Thank you.
So any more questions? Comment? And okay, it's no more than we can finish the sutta class, then we pay respect to the Buddha.